From here we went on to cross the Yagula Pass, meeting no one on the way. After 3 days we came to cultivated land belonging to the large village of Menkapmi. We again introduced ourselves as Indians, and bought straw for our yak and tsampa for ourselves. The people here lead a very hard life. Their barley and lentil fields are strewn with stones and need a great deal of labor to produce a poor crop. But they are cheerful and friendly people, and in the evenings we sat with them and drank beer. On the slopes around the village there are some little monasteries, which the villagers, in spite of the hard lives they lead, keep going with their usual spirit of piety and self-sacrifice. On every side we found ruins of surprising dimensions, bearing witness that this region had seen better times. We could not ascertain if the decline had been due to wars or a change of climate. We had been marching for an hour when we came out into the huge plain of Dingrai. Behind, and we caught our breath, stood the highest mountain in the world, Mount Everest. Full of wonder, enthusiasm, and awe, we looked at the mighty peak and thought of the many expeditions in which brave men had lost their lives vainly trying to win the summit. We made a few sketches of the mountain, which certainly had never been viewed by a European from where we stood. It was hard to turn from this marvelous spectacle, but we had to move on to our next objective, the 18,000-foot pass of Korala, which lay to the north. Before starting to climb, we spent the night in a little hamlet called Kaju, at the foot of the pass. This time we could not pass ourselves off as Indians so easily, because the villagers had seen many Europeans. Nearby was the village of Dingrai, where all the British Everest expeditions used to hire their bearers. The inhabitants seemed to be appraising us and asked us first if we had been to see the Bonpo at Sutso. We then realized that the big house we had seen at that place must have been the official residence. We had noticed the house right enough, as it stood on a hill and commanded a view of the whole district. Luckily, we had got by without being observed. Now we had to be cautious. We did not pursue the subject but repeated our story of being on a pilgrimage. The villagers appeared to be satisfied and told us about the road we should have to follow, which from their account was a good one. Late in the afternoon, we reached the top of the pass. At last we would be going downhill again. We had finished with wearisome ascents for the time being and glad we were of it. Our yak, however, thought otherwise. He broke away and ran back uphill toward the pass. After endless difficulty we managed to catch him, but we could not get him to move and were obliged to camp in a most inhospitable spot where we could not light a fire, and so we supped on dried sampa meal and raw meat. Our only consolation was the distant view of Mount Everest in the sunset glow. The next day Arman again began to create. We tied a rope around his horns and led him over the pass, but he continued to misbehave. We had had enough of Armin for and determined to exchange him at the next opportunity for another animal. Our chance came soon. At the next village I made what I thought was a good bargain and exchanged him for a shaky-looking nag. We were overjoyed and went on our way in high spirits. On the same day we reached a broad valley through which rushed a stream of green water carrying small ice floes with it. It was the Tsangpo Brahmaputra. That disposed of our dream of finding the river frozen and getting across on the ice. But we did not lose heart. On the opposite bank we saw monasteries and a number of houses and reckoned there must be some means of getting across the river. We thought of a ferry, and as we were searching for one, I found the piers of a hanging rope bridge. When we came to it we concluded that the bridge was all right for us to cross but no good for our horse. Animals have to swim, although the coolies manage sometimes to carry their donkeys across the swaying rope bridges on their backs. We tried to drive our horse into the water, but he simply would not budge. By this time we were quite accustomed to having trouble with our animals, so I sadly made up my mind to go back to the village and try to effect a re-exchange. It cost me money and hard words to get back Armin, but I got him. He showed no sign of pleasure or of sorrow at seeing me again. It was dark by the time I brought him back to the bridge. By that time it was too late to get him across, so I tethered him to a stake nearby. Orf Snater had in the meantime found us a lodging, and we passed a pleasant, warm night under cover. The villagers were accustomed to passing traders and took little notice of us. The next morning I forgave Armin all his misdeeds. When we had managed to persuade him to go into the water, he showed himself to be a splendid swimmer. He was often submerged by the rushing water and was carried some way downstream, but that did not disturb him. He swam steadily on, and when he had come to the other side we admired the gallant way in which he breasted the steep bank and shook the water out of his long coat. We spent the rest of the day in the village which was called Chung Rivok, a very interesting place with a famous monastery. This building, which contained a number of temples with Chinese inscriptions on their doors, rose sheer from the rocky walls that flanked the river. One of the most remarkable things about this monastery was an outsize korten, a form of totem, perhaps 70 feet high, which bore witness to the sanctity of the place. Around it were grouped a great number of prayer wheels, I counted up to 800, which continually revolved with their drums containing strips of paper inscribed with prayers entreating the blessing of the gods. It is important that they should be continuously in movement, and I noticed a monk going around and greasing their axles. No devout person passes by the wheels without giving them a turn. Little old men and women often sit by these giant drums for the whole day, turning them with devotion and praying heaven to grant them and those who support them rebirth in a higher state. Others carry little hand wheels with them when they go on pilgrimages. These prayer wheels and the childlike mentality that they express are as typical of Tibet as the cairns and prayer flags we had found on all the mountain passes. As we were very pleased with our quarters and fascinated by all the interesting things we saw here, we decided to remain for another night. It was worth it, as we had a very interesting visitor, a Tibetan who had lived for 22 years in a Christian mission in India and had now returned, homesick for Tibet. Like us, he had wandered alone over the passes through the winter snow, but when he could, he had attached himself to caravans. He showed us English illustrated papers and in them we saw for the first time pictures of bomb cities and read about the end of the war. These were for us shattering moments and we were eager to hear more. In spite of the discouraging news he gave us, we were glad to meet someone who brought us a breath of air from the outside world, our world. What he told us strengthened our resolve to continue our journey into Central Asia. We would have been only too glad to take him with us as a traveling companion but could offer him neither protection nor comfort. We bought from him a few pencils and some paper so that we could continue writing up our diaries, then said goodbye to him and set out alone. Our route now led us away from the Brahmaputra. We followed it over another pass, and in 2 days reached Sangsungjavu and so joined once more the caravan road from Gartok to Lhasa, from which we had branched off a year ago on our way to Kirong. The Bonpo's representative at Sangsungjavu asked us many questions but treated us kindly. We felt that the gentlemanly way in which the two officials at Tre Dun had dealt with us had become known in the surrounding country as Fa Sangsung and had set an example to other authorities. Fortunately, this officer had no idea that we were here contrary to instructions. It was a blessing that he did not put additional difficulty in our way, as we already had worries and to spare. We had to make a decision one way or the other. We had only 80 rupees left and one gold piece. The rest had gone in the purchase of provisions and in buying a fifth yak to replace our latest Armin. We found prices higher as we approached the towns, and it was clearly impossible for us to think of getting through to the Chinese frontier with no more than the money we had. We still had thousands of miles to cover before we came to China. But our money would be enough to get us to Lhasa. There it was again, the lure of the Forbidden City. And the possibility of getting acquainted with the object of our dreams was now almost within our grasp. Anyhow, we could not control our desire to go there, and this new objective seemed to us worth any sacrifice. While we were in the Pau camp, we had greedily read every book we could get that dealt with Lhasa. There were few of these, and all of them had been written by Englishmen. We had learned that in 1904 a British punitive expedition consisting of a small force had marched as far as the capital, and that in the last 20 years several Europeans have visited it. Since that time the world possesses only superficial knowledge of Lhasa, And no goal is more attractive to the explorer than the Dalai Lama's home. And we, so short a distance away, should we not seek to get there? For what other purpose had we overcome every sort of difficulty by cunning and stratagem, exerted ourselves physically to the limit of our endurance, and learned to speak the language of the country? The more we thought about it, the stronger was our resolve, and onto Lhasa became our motto. Our experience had shown us that high officials were much easier to deal with than subordinates. We felt that we should be all right once we got to Lhasa. I kept thinking of a brilliant example we might follow, that of Father Johann Gruber, who smuggled himself into Lhasa in a caravan 300 years ago and was hospitably entertained there. So there was no doubt about our goal, but we were not so sure how to reach it. We were of course attracted by the much frequented high road with its roadhouses. Going by it, we should reach Lhasa in a few weeks. But we risked discovery and arrest. Even if we bypassed Shigatse, the second largest city of Tibet, we should find several other administrative centers on the way, each of which might mar our chances. The risk this way was too great. So we decided to travel through the northern plains, which they call Chengthang. This district is inhabited solely by nomads with whom we could safely associate. Then, we thought, we could approach Lhasa from the northwest. No one expects foreigners to come from that direction, and it would be easier for us to slip into the town. Sven Hedin made a similar plan 40 years ago, but it failed owing to the obstinacy of some local officials. His failure to reach Lhasa may have seemed a great misfortune to him personally, but it enabled him to explore regions hitherto completely unknown. There were no maps or accounts of the route that we meant to follow, we simply had to push on into the unknown, always aiming for the northeast. We should probably meet nomads here and there on our way and get them to put us wise about directions and distances. While in Sangsang we naturally said nothing about our plans but gave out that we wished to go to the salt deposits in the north. People were horrified at the idea and tried hard to dissuade us. The country was so inhospitable that only lunatics would wish to go there. But our deception had the desired result of removing any suspicion that we might be bound for Lhasa. Our plan, as a matter of fact, involved considerable dangers, and the icy blizzards we encountered in Sangsang gave us an idea of what to expect. Nevertheless, we set out on December 2, 1945. While at Sangsang we had made friends with some Sherpas. These people are Tibetans who live mostly in Nepal and have made a name for themselves as guides and bearers in the Himalayas. They are nicknamed the Tigers of the Himalayas. They gave us valuable advice regarding our preparations and helped us to find a new yak, which was a real service to us, as we had hitherto invariably been swindled when we bought one of these creatures. We noted with satisfaction that our new yak was a well-behaved beast. He was a powerful bull, black with a few white flecks, and his long flowing coat nearly swept the ground. In his youth his horns had been removed and the operation seemed to have improved his temper without diminishing his strength. He wore the usual nose ring. With a very little encouragement, one could get him to exceed his average speed of 2 miles an hour. The poor devil had a lot of weight to carry, as we had made it a rule always to have at least 8 days' rations with us. Our first day out from Sangsang passed without difficulties. Our way led through a gently rising valley. Just as the sun went down and the biting cold began to penetrate our clothing, we saw, as if we had ordered it, a black nomad tent. It was pitched in the shelter of a surrounding stone called Waihega. One finds these enclosures scattered over the whole of Tibet, as the nomads are always moving to new pastures, and when they do, they put stone fences around their tents. The leggers also help to protect their beasts against the cold and the attacks of wolves. As we approached the tent, some dogs made for us, barking. The noise brought a nomad out of the tent. He was not very forthcoming when we asked for a night's shelter, and flatly refused to allow us into his tent, but afterward he brought us some dried yak dung with which to make a fire. We had to camp in the open, but eventually made ourselves fairly comfortable, We collected a lot of juniper branches with which we managed to keep a good fire going throughout the night. All the same, I could not sleep. I had a feeling in the pit of my stomach reminding me of my sensations before tackling the north wall of the Eiger. It is certainly a good thing that we did not know what lay before us. Had we had even a faint idea of it, we would certainly have turned back. We were setting out into terra incognita, marked only by blank spaces on the maps, magnetized by the ambition of the explorer. The next day we reached the top of the pass and were astonished to find that there was no descent and that we had simply come to a high plateau. The view over the unending plain was discouraging. One seemed to be facing infinity, and the huge spaces would certainly take months to cross. As far as we could see, there was no sign of life, and a nice cold wind blew over the snow. We spent the following night in abandoned leggers, finding enough yak's dung to make a fire. In summer, nomads evidently lived here, and caravans passed through the region. The snow plains were then, no doubt, green alpine pastures, and the thought of them reminded us that we had not chosen the best time of year for our journey. Then we had a lucky day. We ran into a tent and got a warm reception from an old married couple and their son, who had been camping there for several months. They had had a hard time of it, and since the heavy snowfalls 8 weeks before had hardly left their tent. Many of their yaks and sheep had died since the deep snow had buried their pasture. The rest stood apathetically near the tent or kicked up the snow with their hoofs in the hope of finding fodder. These heavy falls of snow are rare in Central Asia and do not count among the normal risks of life. Our hosts seemed glad to see human faces again. This was the first time that we had been invited into a nomad's tent and asked to stay the night. We were taken for Indians and aroused no suspicion. There was plenty of meat, as many of the animals had had to be killed. We bought a leg of yak for a sang and at once sawed off a huge chunk with a cookery in order to make a meal. Our hosts were horrified to hear of the route we proposed to take and strongly advised us to give it up. However, in the course of conversation they did say that we should find other nomad tents on our road, and this information strengthened our determination to carry on. The next day, soon after setting out, we ran into a deep snow drift. Walking with our inadequate footwear soon became a torture. The upper crust of snow was treacherous, and we and our yak often broke through. In some places there were streams running under the snow, and we found ourselves wading through ice-cold water, which we could feel but not see, and our shoes and stockings were soon frozen stiff. We had an exhausting day and covered only a few miles. Glad indeed we were to see another nomad tent toward evening. This time the inmates did not invite us to come inside, but they were not unfriendly and pitched a little yak hair tent for us. I was happy to be able at last to remove my shoes from my smarting feet. Some of my toes showed signs of frostbite, but I rubbed them for a long time and at last the circulation came back. The difficulties of this day's march and the warning of frostbite had made us anxious, and Ofsnator and I had a long and earnest talk. We could still return, and we thought seriously of doing so. We were worried about our yak, which had not eaten properly for days, and we could reckon on our fingers how many days he would last. But we could not think of going on without him. For a long time we argued backward and forward, and eventually came to a compromise solution. We would continue our march for one more day and then decide. Our decision would depend on the snow conditions. The next day we passed through undulating country till we came to a pass. On crossing it, what was our astonishment but to find no more snow? Providence had decided for us. We soon ran into a nomad's tent, where we were well received and allowed to graze our yak to his heart's content. This time our hostess was a young woman. She quickly made us cups of butter tea, and for the first time I drank this brew with relish. The warmth ran through our frozen bodies and brought us to life again. Only then did we notice what a picturesque figure our young hostess made. Over her bare skin she wore a sheepskin cloak reaching down to the ground. In her long black pigtail she wore mussel shells, silver coins, and various cheap ornaments imported from abroad. She told us that her two husbands had gone out to drive in the animals. She said they had 1,500 sheep and a great many yaks. We were astonished to find polyandry practiced among the nomads. It was only when we were in Lhasa that we came to know all the complicated reasons that led to the simultaneous existence in Tibet of polyandry and polygamy. The two men, when they came home, greeted us as warmly as their wife had done. An abundant supper was prepared and we even got sour milk to drink. This was a pleasure we had not enjoyed since we used to help the butter makers in Kirong. We sat for a long while in comfort by the fire and felt ourselves rewarded for the hardships of the road. We laughed and jested much, and as is usual when the company consists of several men and a single pretty young woman, the latter got her share of teasing. We started fresh and rested the next day, and were glad to have left the lonely snowy landscape behind us. We saw signs of life here and there. Herds of wild goats showed themselves on the slopes and sometimes came so near that a pistol would have given us a steak for our dinner. Unfortunately, we hadn't one. It was a pleasant surprise to find more friendly nomads as evening fell. They called in their dogs as we approached and we decided to rest for a day among them and give our yak a chance of grazing on their fertile pastures. In winter the men living a nomad life have not much to do. They busy themselves with various household chores and for recreation go hunting with their antiquated muzzle loaders. The women collect yak dung and often carry their babies around with them as they work. In the evening the herds are driven in and the cows milked, though it is little they give in winter. As one can imagine, the nomads have the simplest methods of cooking. In winter they eat almost exclusively meat with as much fat as possible. They also eat different kinds of soup. Sampa, the staple diet in agricultural districts, is a rarity here. The whole life of the nomads is organized so as to make the most of the scanty aids to living which nature provides. At night they sleep on skins spread upon the ground and, slipping out of the sleeves, use their sheepskin cloaks as bedclothes. Before they get up in the morning, they blow up the still live embers of their fire with a bellows and the first thing they do is to make tea. The fire is the heart of the household and is never allowed to go out. As in every peasant's house, one finds an altar in every tent, which usually consists of a simple chest on which is set an amulet or a small statue of the Buddha. There is invariably a picture of the Dalai Lama. A little butter lamp burns on the altar, and in winter the flame is almost invisible owing to the cold and the lack of oxygen. The greatest event of the year in the life of the nomads is the annual market in Jayaniema to which they drive their flocks and barter some of their sheep for grain. And there they buy household articles, needles, aluminium pots and pans, and brightly colored ornaments for the women. We were sorry to be on the road once more after a glimpse of domestic life. We would have wished to do something to repay the hospitality of these people. We gave them small presents of colored yarn and paprika, that was all we had. For a time after this we covered from 10 to 20 miles each day, according to whether we found tents on our route or not. Often enough we had to bivouac in the open. At those times it took us all our energy to collect yak dung and find water, and even talking was a waste of strength. We suffered much with our hands, which were always stiff with frost, for we had no gloves and used a pair of socks instead. Once a day we cooked meat and ladled the gravy straight out of the simmering saucepan. One could do that here without fear of scalding one's tongue as the boiling point was so low. We cooked at night, and warmed up anything that was left over before we started in the morning. We marched through the whole day without halting. I could write a chapter on the miseries of our nights, when we lay close together often unable to sleep because of the cold and the countless lice that tormented us. The reader must imagine what we suffered. On December 13th, we reached Labrang Trawa, a settlement consisting of a single house. The family to which the house belonged used it only for camping and lived in their tent which they had pitched nearby. When we asked them why, they replied that the tent was far warmer. We gathered from their conversation that we had landed in an official's residence. The Bonpo was away, but his brother acted for him. The latter began to ask us questions, but soon seemed to be satisfied with our tale of being pilgrims. For the first time we admitted that we wished to go to Lhasa, for at this point we were at a safe distance from the caravan route. Our man shook his head in horror and tried to make us understand that the quickest and best way to Lhasa was by way of Shigatse. I had my answer ready. We had chosen the hard way in order that our pilgrimage might have greater merit. He was impressed by this explanation and gladly gave us good advice. He said we had a choice of two courses. The first was to follow a route which was very difficult. It would take us over many passes and tracts of uninhabited country. The second was easier, but it meant going through the middle of the Kampa's country. There it was again, the name Kampa, spoken in a mysterious tone, which we had already heard from so many nomads. Kampa must mean an inhabitant of the eastern province of Tibet, which is called Kham. But you never heard the name mentioned without an undertone of ear and warning. At last we realized that the word was synonymous with robber. We, unfortunately, made light of the warning and chose the easier route. We spent 2 nights with the Bonpo's family, not unfortunately as guests in their tent, as the proud Tibetans did not deem us poor Indians worthy of such an honor. But the Bonpo's brother was a very impressive fellow. He was serious-minded and sparing in his speech, but when he said anything it made sense. He shared his brother's wife and lived on his flocks. The family seemed to be well off, and they lived in a considerably larger tent than those of most nomads. We were able to replenish our stores, and money was accepted for our purchases as a matter of course. The worst trek of all. We had been some time on the way when a man came towards us wearing clothes that struck us as unusual. He spoke a dialect different from that of the local nomads. He asked us curiously whence, and whither. And we told him our pilgrimage story. He left us unmolested and went on his way. It was clear to us that we had made the acquaintance of our first camper. A few hours later we saw in the distance 2 men on small ponies, wearing the same sort of clothes. We slowly began to feel uncomfortable and went on without waiting for them. Long after dark we came across a tent. Here we were lucky, as it was inhabited by a pleasant nomad family, who hospitably invited us to come in and gave us a special fireplace for ourselves. In the evening we got to talking about the robbers. They were, it seems, a regular plague. Our host had lived long enough in the district to make an epic about them. He proudly showed us a Mannlicht rifle for which he had paid a fortune to a camper, 500 sheep, no less. But the robber bands in the neighborhood considered this payment as a sort of tribute and had left him in peace ever since. He told us something about the life of the robbers. They live in groups in 3 or 4 tents, which serve as headquarters for their campaigns. These are conducted as follows. Heavily armed with rifles and swords, they force their way into a nomad's tent and insist on hospitable entertainment on the most lavish scale available. The nomad in terror brings out everything he has. The campers fill their bellies and their pockets and, taking a few cattle with them, for good measure, disappear into the wide open spaces. They repeat the performance at another tent every day till the whole region has been skinned. Then they move their headquarters and begin again somewhere else. The nomads, who have no arms, resign themselves to their fate, and the government is powerless to protect them in these remote regions. However, if once in a while a district officer gets the better of these footpads in a skirmish, he is not the loser by it, for he has a right to all the booty. Savage punishment is meted out to the evildoers, who normally have their arms hacked off. But this does not cure campers of their lawlessness. Stories were told of the cruelty with which they sometimes put their victims to death. They go so far as to slaughter pilgrims and wandering monks and nuns. A disturbing conversation for us. What would we not have given to be able to buy our host's Mannlicht? But we had no money and not even the most primitive weapons. The tent pegs we carried did not impress even the sheepdogs. The next morning we went on our way. Not without misgivings, which increased when we saw a man with a gun, who seemed to be stalking us from the hillside. Nevertheless, we kept straight on our course, and the man eventually disappeared. In the evening we found more tents, first a single one and then a cluster of others. We called to the people in the first tent. A family of nomads came out. They refused with expressions of horror to admit us and pointed distractedly to the other tents. There was nothing to do but to go on. We were no little surprised to receive a friendly welcome at the next tent. Everyone came out.